Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
There was always a baron of beef or a shoulder or leg of lamb before my father.
That's from an opening scene of the film How Green Was My Valley, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1941. That same year, another little film was snubbed from the red carpet.
Rosebud.
Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. Enraged at the title character's obvious likeness to himself, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst did everything in his power to destroy Citizen Kane. Although he could not prevent its release, he was able to squash its success at the box office and foil its chances for Best Picture. Hearst's attack was the first and perhaps most aggressive smear campaign in the Academy Awards' 86-year history, but there have been plenty more since. Here with a few is Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast. Hello, Marlo.
Hey, Virginia. How's it going?
Very well. Some really dirty stuff here. Funny that some of these smear campaigns do get remembered long after the ceremony, as in the case of Good Will Hunting back in 1998. What was the smear then?
Right. So this was a Harvey Weinstein film, so he wasn't behind it. But the smear was that William Goldman, writer of All the President's Men, had written it, but then he later confessed that he didn't. And then after that, Variety ran a story insinuating that Ted Talley, writer of Silence of the Lambs, wrote the screenplay, which, again, turned out to be a completely ridiculous claim. And I think just a lot of people had a hard time wrapping their head around the fact that these two boys from Boston, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, with dimples, could churn out such a good screenplay.
Well, and I say that they get remembered because we were sitting around when we were talking about this thinking, wait, did they actually write this? You know, so these kind of things carry over. In general, who orchestrates them? The studios or competing nominees?
It's a mixture of both, but I think it's usually the competing nominees. I mean, Matt Damon later told the New York Times that the Ted Talley stuff all came from the, quote, As Good As It Gets camp, which was the other nominee that year for Best Original Screenplay, was James Brooks. But obviously, he said the filmmaker had nothing to do with that. It was these, perhaps the publicists that the film had hired for their Oscar campaign.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Well, the year after that, 1999, another smear against Saving Private Ryan. What happened?
Right. In 1999, the two big Best Picture contenders were Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg's big World War II epic, and Shakespeare in Love, which was a comparatively smaller film. And the first thing that happened was that Harvey Weinstein spent an enormous amount of money promoting Shakespeare in Love during Oscar season, something like $5 to $10 million on the Oscar campaign, which was unheard of at the time. It was usually studios, especially small studios like Miramax, would only spend around $1 million for their Oscar campaign. But he spent $5 to $10 million and really raised the bar as far as Oscar spending goes for ads. But the thing that really probably hurt Saving Private Ryan's chances the most were all these stories that came out in the press that said that the British were, quote, riled by Ryan, and that a group of British World War II veterans felt slighted by Spielberg's film because during the Omaha Beach sequence, which is the most riveting scene in the film, The C Company of the U.S. Rangers 2nd Battalion is seen being dispatched by U.S. ships, when in actuality, the British Royal Navy dispatched them to Omaha Beach. So a bunch of stories started surfacing in the press saying that surviving British members of the Royal Navy were pissed off that they weren't included in the film.
Well, the Weinstein brothers come up again. Shakespeare in Love did take the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1999. They obviously didn't invent the dirty politics, but how much gets tied back to them?
You know, they definitely changed the game a little bit. I mean, during the year that Gangs of New York was up for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture, and it was really Martin Scorsese's comeback, they even took out ads that said that Robert Wise, the director of Sound of Music, praised Gangs in New York and said it should win Best Picture, when it came out that not only had Robert Wise not penned this open letter praising Gangs in New York, it was penned by a Miramax publicist, and Robert Wise just signed it. And so the Academy had to develop new rules. So now you can't really get former Academy members to publicly endorse nominees.
Well, how about put down a film? Because in 2006, it was a couple of esteemed actors that helped scupper the chances for Brokeback Mountain. Tell us the story behind that.
This is one of the more bizarre smear campaigns waged during Oscar season. Yeah, in 2006, it was Crash, Paul Haggis's racial relations drama, versus Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, this beautiful cowboy love story. And yeah, two veteran actors, Tony Curtis and Ernest Borgnine, took it upon themselves to violently campaign against Brokeback Mountain out of nowhere, it seems. They didn't even see the movie. They appeared on Fox News saying some homophobic remarks. And it was most surprising coming from Tony Curtis because he had starred in Some Like It Hot, which is, you know, one of the biggest...
cross-dressing comedies?
Quote-unquote gay films. Yeah, cross-dressing comedies of all time. And it ended up hurting Brokeback Mountain, and it lost to Crash for Best Picture. The other thing that happened, though, was that the producers of Crash also sent out 130,000 Oscar screeners to virtually every member of the Screen Actors Guild and the Academy, which was also unprecedented.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together, had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
Well, we have two interesting, almost side-by-side examples of The Hurt Locker in 2010, Catherine Bigelow's film, when she was up against her ex-husband, James Cameron, who produced the multi-million-dollar film Avatar. And then just a couple of years later, her film Zero Dark Thirty about the bin Laden raid. If you could just tell us a little bit about the politics or the inner politicking of those campaigns, how they played out differently, and why you think they did.
Sure. They both involved Catherine Bigelow films, but they were very different smear campaigns. I mean, the first example, 2010's The Hurt Locker, when it was up for Best Picture versus Avatar, which obviously made close to $3 billion, whereas The Hurt Locker had only grossed, you know, less than $50 million worldwide, and I think under $20 million in the U.S., becoming, I believe, the lowest grossing Best Picture winner ever, although... you'll have to check my fact work on that. But all these stories seem to come out around the time of The Hurt Locker, of ex-bomb disposal experts questioning its authenticity, claiming that it didn't depict combat accurately. And also the producer of The Hurt Locker, or one of the producers on The Hurt Locker, Nicholas Chartier, came out and wrote this mass email to all his friends and fellow Oscar voters asking him to vote for his film over a, quote, $500 million film, saying that, you know, voting for Hill's film would be beneficial to the independent film industry, while if you vote for Avatar, you're basically just patting Hollywood on the back. So all these things started to come out around the release of Hurt Locker. Thankfully, The Hurt Locker wasn't affected by it and went on to win six Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Catherine Bigelow, making her the first woman ever to win the award. Now, the case of Zero Dark Thirty is a little different. I mean, with Zero Dark Thirty, from the word go, it was under attack by every op-ed writer, it seemed, saying that it promoted torture. Frank Bruni, the New York Times columnist, penned this crazy op-ed with the opening line, "I'm betting that Dick Cheney will love the new movie Do Zero Dark Thirty." Mm-hmm. And Bigelow and screenwriter and her partner at the time, Mark Bull, who was an ex-journalist himself, claimed the contrary and, you know, wrote their own op-eds and came out in defense of the film. But still, it caused a lot of controversy. And the film, even though it had, you know, it was the most critically acclaimed film of the year, it had the highest Metacritic score of any film that year, it only managed to win one Oscar for Best Sound Editing when all was said and done.
Marlo Stern is with us. He's entertainment editor at the Daily Beast, and he created a list of some recent Oscar smear campaigns. You can find them. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, I guess that's a question. The New York Times seems to have been behind it in that case. Do smear campaigns get set in motion by a motivated party, or do you think maybe the attention that nominees get just attracts a greater scrutiny?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, on the one hand, films do hire these specialty awards publicists during award season that may have a hand in concocting a lot of these campaigns. And on the other hand, I think the media plays off it as well because it's interesting, enticing copy, and people enjoy reading about scandals. So they are, while they are mostly manufactured scandals, they prove enticing to the public.
We have two big scandals going on during this Oscar season. One, Woody Allen, his film Blue Jasmine, is up for an award. He's mired in allegations of sexual abuse of his daughter and his defense of that. The other movie that seems to be in the crosshairs is The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese's film about the, let's say, exuberant excesses of Wall Street.
Right. It seems that from the time it was released, The Wolf of Wall Street has been under fire by a lot of people for basically being a celebration of this shady stockbroker played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And since it's based on a memoir, Jordan Belfort's memoir of the same name, and features DiCaprio, who is this attractive movie star, playing the shady stockbroker and doing, scamming all these people through various pump and dump schemes and living this jet set lifestyle, they think that he's going to be this generation's Gordon Gekko, basically, because, and I don't think it really does promote this viewpoint, and it doesn't really glamorize it. Some people will get that impression from it.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man, and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time.
Two of the films that are targeted this year by campaigns, Wolf of Wall Street and Blue Jasmine, they're both underdogs for Best Picture as it is. Now, why not spend all the time and money orchestrating a better campaign against American Hustle or 12 Years a Slave, which are actually favored this Oscar season?
I don't know. You know, I just think that it makes a better story. I mean, it's tough to attack something like 12 Years a Slave for a number of reasons.
A share of attacks for being torture porn, hasn't it?
Right, right. But most of those attacks have been from legitimate crazy people like Armand White, the film critic that recently got booted from the New York Film Critics Circle. But Wolf of Wall Street in particular, I think it's just an easier target for people. And it really, it deals with issues that trouble a lot of people today, which are that, you know, the fat cats on Wall Street have essentially gotten away with it and keep getting away with it. And so when you have this film that glamorizes this or that people think are glamorizing this, then it can be troubling for the public.
Marlo, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast. To find a link to read more about the recent Oscar smear campaigns, that's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we'll go from the dark side of the film industry to some of the most memorable and beautiful bits. A look into the precise art of title sequences when Word of Mouth continues.